All right, we're ready to begin our next session. So grab what you need and come on back in. And we are taking, we'll give Vincent an hour and 15 minutes. We're a bit flexible. That's what was scheduled initially for his lecture. We'll give him that full hour and 15 minutes. And then we will adjust breakout sessions. Let me just say a word about the breakout sessions so you know as you're coming in. There will be two breakout sessions, and the first one will consist of a teaching time, some of it going a little bit further on the subject matter that was addressed by the speaker, some a little bit different direction. You can see in your notebooks there are explanations and descriptions. If you'll find that on pages 4 and 5 at the end. Before we actually do that, I will say a word about that at the end here of the lecture before the break. So I want you to know that. Look at them. The second session of the breakout is more of an opportunity. Again, you can read about it, but it's more of an opportunity for us to interact. There's a lot of good content. There are a lot of good things that we're thinking about and processing. And as you've heard some of these questions, that you live on the front lines. And it's not that those of us here that are serving you on the front lines are not on the front line in another capacity. We are members of local churches and serving in various capacities and various ways, and many serve as elders, but a little differently than a vocational elder as you are. And so it's an opportunity to address some issues that I will raise for this second breakout session, and then issues that you want to talk about. Issues that you want to raise, that you might seek input across those that are in that particular group. We also, because we are brothers and sisters in ministry, we will also spend some time praying together. There's learning, there's praying, there's professing belief, not just with our eyes open, but also with our eyes closed. There is a very important reason and purpose for praying together as well. Well, as we move from understanding culture, or at least seeking to understand culture a little bit better, and seeking to understand ministry and how the culture has influenced our reading of the Bible and those sorts of things. And then moving to church history and understanding how the early church lived and propagated the gospel and lived the gospel and loved not just one another, but loved others, the unlovely, and those sorts of things. In fact, that was the mark of a Christian, as Francis Schaeffer said in his book, was really what John wrote that was observed of the early church. It was love. And I would say now we begin to get a little bit more specific. So what does the gospel mean as it's lived out in day-to-day life? What does it mean, and how would it manifest itself as we love God and love one another? And I think one of the significant ways that it ought to manifest is in racial issues. We who are Bible believers, we who believe that the Church of Jesus Christ is an outpost of heaven, that is that we here on earth, we often understand the church going upwards rather than the church understood downwards. That is to say, we are gathered around the throne now, Hebrews 12. So our gatherings here in a local setting ought to reflect heaven. That is a manifestation of the gospel that we proclaim with our lips. Which is why we have much to learn about living as a moral minority in this changing culture, a moral minority in this post-Christian day from those who lived as a Christian and a minority. We need to hear and learn from those fellow Christians who have faithfully lived out the gospel in the midst of extremely difficult circumstances. And one fellow brothers and sisters that comes immediately to the fore are African American brothers and sisters. And as we together learn how to live out the gospel in this present day, with its challenges, I believe we become a visible manifestation and a powerful apologetic for the gospel. Vincent Bacote is Associate Professor of Theology and Director of the Center for Applied Christian Ethics at Wheaton. We're grateful you're here finally, but we're grateful you're here with us. Please come.
Hopefully I won't have to bend down and get that, but we'll see. We'll see. Well, it's great to be here instead of languishing in an airport or wondering, is that flight going to be canceled? So I'm glad to be here and to be with you. Oh, thank you. So I want to begin by, and you have this in your outline in front of you, talking about what two things do for us to put the question of the legacy of racism and ethnocentrism in front of us. So Nelson Mandela died recently. And in all of the coverage about Nelson Mandela, of course there's going to be conversation about apartheid. And I mean, there's lots of conversation about Mandela's legacy as someone who said, don't call me a saint, a person who was certainly a man of character who did a very surprising thing as president by having his jailer there at his inauguration, being a person who put bitterness behind him as he walked out of jail. But it also raises the question for us about, well, why was he in jail in the first place, and what were the circumstances of that, and what was that legacy of apartheid? And you can't think about apartheid without thinking about the question of race. Now, apartheid is a little different than the way things have worked out on these shores, but apartheid was very evil, I think we can say. And we can also observe that there were many Christians who thought apartheid was just fine and who had their own apologetic for it. There are people who even used my dissertation figure, Abraham Kuyper, as used some of his thoughts as a rationale for why the races should stay apart. But I just want to mention the fact that Mandela's death puts it in front of us. And, I mean, if you hadn't thought about apartheid for well over a decade, you know, which would make sense because it's been at least two decades since apartheid ended, it put it back in front of us and reminded us of how horrific that was. And I also talk about here, and I'll say a little bit more about this, the film 12 Years a Slave, which has been nominated for Best Picture for the Academy Awards and has won lots of accolades, it also squarely puts the legacy of racism and ethnocentrism in front of us. Now, I put on your outline there the line, though it may be in front of us, we may find ourselves tempted to avert our gaze. And that's what I want us to avoid. And one of the reasons we're talking about 12 Years a Slave is because part of what it does cinematically is put things in front of you where you would really like to avert your gaze. Two scenes, for example, that I'll note. One, there is the scene where Solomon Northrop, who was a man who had his family, he was a free man up in the North, he's kidnapped by slave traders. And he winds up being transported to the South and sold into slavery. The first plantation with a relatively benevolent slaveholder, one of the hands doesn't like him. And there's a scene where he strings him up. But what the camera does in this hanging scene is the camera just stays on it. And what you see him is with the noose around his neck, and his feet are just touching the ground. And he's continually just adjusting his feet so as to not be asphyxiated by the noose. And the camera doesn't move. There are a lot of other interesting things that go on with that scene, but the biggest thing is you're just there watching him try to hold on to his life. And the backdrop of, you know, like the plantation, it makes it clear the context where this is happening. And what you want to do, of course, if you're just staring at this, is you want to look away. But you can't look away. I mean, you can try, but you basically have to leave the theater to do it. There's a second scene where, at the second plantation he's at, because his slave master, the other one, says, you will get killed if you stay here by these other people. It's a very, very harsh slave master, who is, surprise, surprise, in love with one of his slaves, which his wife does not like. And there's a scene where his wife demands that he whip this slave. And he can't bring himself to do it. So he makes Solomon Northrop, another slave, whip her. And the camera faces Solomon's here. She has her hands tied around this post. And then he whips her. And of course, he's not doing it all that hard because he doesn't want to be doing this. And then, of course, the slave master says, he basically compels him to literally beat her within an inch of her life. And you sit there, and you hear it, and you hear her scream, and the camera doesn't move. It's horrible. It's horrific. And you want to avert your gaze. But the only way you can avert your gaze is basically by running out of the theater. And the reason I'm mentioning this is basically because it's something that, a name you may not hear often at E-Free Church conferences, but it's something that James Cone said. James Cone was being interviewed about his book, The Cross and the Lynching Tree. And he was asked, why lynching? And he said, because lynching is ugly. And people don't like to look at ugly things. But we need to look at this ugly thing. And my point is about this is that if we're going to talk about learning from a moral from what people who've been ethnic minorities, in being more minorities ourselves or transitioning into that, it's very hard to learn from people if you don't really look at the circumstance. If you try to say, well, it's history, we don't need to talk about it. I mean, it's really hard to learn from something that you refuse to really know, that you refuse to really engage. So you have to engage it. You have to look at it in its ugliness. And it's a hard thing to do. And it's a thing that can easily create misunderstanding, and people want to do this. So that's why I have down there two brief personal experiences. Some time ago, when we had the task force for diversity in the Evangelical Free Church, Dan Reeve and I put together this thing called It's Not Political Correctness that we did a few times. And so I did it at a regional conference of Minnesota. Now, just the way the schedule worked out, maybe this is what the problem was. I wound up having to do it while people were eating dinner. Of course, if you're doing a presentation while people are eating dinner, they may feel that they are being subjected to something whether they chose to be there or not. I don't know because I can't read anyone's minds. And maybe even some of you were there. I don't know. But it was interesting to read the feedback on my presentation. Now, most people who know me would not call me an angry black man. But somebody said that they thought I was. Or people thought that I was kind of, you know, offensive and radical. You know, hey, Jeff Bingham, he's there in the back, my department chair. You can ask him about how radical I am. Ask people at Wheaton about, you know, me, the political catalyst. The point is that it was disappointing to me that there was a lot of negative feedback. I don't know the reason for all the negative feedback. It wasn't clear. But the point of that whole presentation was just to say, if we're Bible people, we can't say that talking about race is just a commitment to political correctness or succumbing to a culture of political correctness. And I don't think that that was heard, at least by some people. More recently, about a year ago, I was the Martin Luther King Day speaker, or Martin in that month, at Regent University. That's the one in Virginia Beach, not the one in Vancouver. Okay, I mean, but both very lovely places. Very nice context. Well, so I did a chapel address, which most people liked, except for one person that sent me a very long email. Saying that they were hurt, disappointed, and insulted by what I said. And then this person proceeded to lecture me like I was a 25-year-old. Now, maybe she thought I was. People say I look younger than I am. But it was clear that she did not really get what I said. I mean, perhaps it was because at the beginning I used the word white supremacy, which no one else seemed to be offended by. I mean, because I checked it out with other people. They liked what I had to say, and they weren't black people. But she said, I've never been called a white supremacist before. I didn't call her a white supremacist. I described what it was. But apparently she took it kind of personally. It was a hard email to read. I mean, this was not like a couple of paragraphs. This is more like a couple of pages in terms of how long it was. All kinds of very interesting things she said in there. I thought about personally responding point by point and did not. And I talk about those two experiences because when we talk about race, a lot of times what people want to do is, you know, this, or walk out, or whatever. But we can't be serious about looking at something if we don't really look at it, if we want to play pretend. And so that brings me to the first point about being our issue and our mission. If the EFCA is an association of churches committed to the Bible, committed to the obligations of the gospel, then it's interesting to me how sometimes issues of race are not seen as being related to this. Now, it's possible, I imagine, because if you're committed to the Bible, one of the things that can happen is you go, well, look, I don't see the word racism in the Bible. I don't see some of these specific things in the Bible. You're right. You're right. But there are many things that we do and many things that we talk about biblically and theologically where the word isn't in the Bible. And the fact of the matter is this. There are any number of crises of various kinds, you know, in the culture, and not necessarily related to race at all. Just because they aren't specifically stated in Scripture doesn't mean Scripture doesn't speak to them or that they're not an expression of something that Scripture talks about. In the case of this big thing called the modern history of race, which, you know, has some significant problems, here's why it's biblical. Because it is a fundamental violation of the first and second greatest commandments. That's why. Because the modern conception of race is something that emerges with modern science, this sort of mastering of nature, mastering of reality that happens to be happening in Europe. I mean, lots of great things happen from it. We get things like modern medicine from it. I'm for modern medicine, okay? But what happens in this excitement about describing things, people start categorizing human beings. And in that categorizing of human beings, it winds up making some human beings more human than others. And it winds up creating an idolatry of certain humans and the opposite, the antithesis, if you don't fit what the idol is. I mean, that's a violation, I think, of the first greatest commandment, because it's loving this mythological thing called whiteness, because white doesn't really exist. Right? We just heard a joke about, like, Swedes, right? You know, in the Free Church, you have jokes about Swedes and Norwegians, you know. Not a whole lot about people from Finland, but the point is this, right? I mean, those are ethnic identities. And I'm sure at some point, you've all probably wondered at some point, well, what's white anyway? I mean, you know, who's really white? You might say, well, maybe somebody in, like, Liverpool or something. But the fact is that most of us don't think of anyone actually having white skin. Or people actually having actual black skin. And then there's everything in between. Okay, I mean, it's a mythology. But in that mythology, it developed in a way where it violates the first greatest commandment, which is essentially a positive way of stating the first of the Ten Commandments. The first of the Ten Commandments, you shall have no other gods before me. Greatest commandment, Jesus says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. If you're doing that, you can't have any other gods. But that's part of what it does. The second violation is of the second greatest commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. Trafficking in human persons seems to be a very peculiar way of loving people as yourself. Creating systems that oppress other human beings and attaching that oppression to the construction of race strikes me as a very peculiar way of loving your neighbor as yourself. And particularly when, in some of this, people thought that you kind of can soften it by saying, well, at least we'll make Christians of them. So, my point is that to say it's not a biblical issue because the word racism is in the Bible is not looking closely enough. Ask what it really is. What it really is an expression of what humans have been doing since Genesis 3. Finding some way to look at another human that's not like them in some way and to find a way to destroy them. That's been going on ever since Genesis 3. It's not a new thing. It's very typical. It's just a very sophisticated version of it. That's all that it is. That's all that it is. And I think we see in many ways the scripture condemns that. So that's why racism is something for us to deal with. Not just because of the label of what is the label per se, but what is it actually? What actually has gone on with all of that? So if we're committed to all that scripture teaches, then we can't ignore it. We can't say it's unbiblical. We can't say the Bible doesn't talk about it. It does. It uses a different label. A label that applies to other expressions besides just that one particular thing itself. But it definitely talks about it. It talks about it. Another reason we have to do this is because we have to deal with the world that we live in. We are in the modern West. The modern West, there's a lot of great things about the modern West. Yeah, I mean, we can just marvel about the modern world in so many ways. But like with anything else, you know, nothing is perfect and everything has its imperfections. Everything has its dark side, its shadow side. And because of that shadow side, we have to deal with that. And in the modern West, we've had this trajectory with race. We had chattel slavery in the United States. Then after chattel slavery, that went away, but then Jim Crow came along, which was kind of a way to kind of keep the system in place. And then that eventually went away, and you get the Civil Rights Act of 64 and 65. And you have other attempts at trying to address some of the issues. And it can be easier for us to say, look, we've passed legislation, these things are illegal, no one would really, you know, want to have a society like this anyway, and I see all people alike, etc. Now, I wish we all did see all people alike, right? But I mean, I defy anyone to tell me that they see every person alike. It's impossible. We can't. Our relationships don't allow us to do that. We don't know people well, everyone well enough to see them all the same way. You know, I mean, it's just a falsehood. So if you want to say, I want to give people the benefit of a doubt or something, let's go with that. But let's not engage in the falsehood of saying, I see all people alike, because nobody does. Nobody does it. It's impossible. I mean, I don't see my kids like I see my wife. It's impossible. The reason that we need to keep dealing with this, larger than this, honestly, is because there's a seduction to believe, because of relative success of certain minorities, and because things are way better, believe me, way better than they were even 50 years ago, certainly than 150 years ago, etc., we can think that that means that there's no more problems. But there's two illustrations I'd like you to think about. The first is this. So, yeah, I live near Chicago, so I'm near Lake Michigan. Now, if an asteroid landed in the middle of Lake Michigan, okay, there would be some gigantic waves at first, right? Big waves. And when the big waves happen, you know, everyone pays attention to the big waves, and wow, look at that, and people try to deal with it. But here's the thing. Those aren't the only waves. Waves keep coming for a long time. A long time. They keep coming up and showing up on the shore all the time. And they're still showing up on our shores with what's happened with the modern conception of race. It keeps happening. Perhaps the easier analogy to think of is a psychological one. Perhaps in ministry you've dealt with someone who's been abused a lot. And the abuse it stopped for a couple of years. Now, what would happen if you said to this person that had been abused for, say, a couple of decades, and the abuse had stopped for 4 or 5 years, and you said to them, just get over it. I'm sure it's all done. Okay? Using that psychological metaphor to think about the sort of psychology of the West, you know, we can't get over it yet. Because a lot of positive things have been done. But if you have a few centuries of something, and then just because things have been better for a few decades, it doesn't mean that everything that you, all those inputs from a couple of centuries just went away. I wish it had. I wish they did. But for that to be the case would be for us to really be disingenuous. And for us to fail to face the fact that sort of the psychology of the modern West still has to deal with the fact that you construct something over several centuries, and then because you start altering it with some legislation for a couple of decades, you don't make things just disappear. And when, whether it's explicit or unintentional, when that's part of the world that Christians have inhabited, and whether they've intended to or not, they've breathed some of that air, you have to at least ask, how has this affected us? How has it affected me? What would I like to really believe is the case? But what is the case? I mean, that's what we have to do, honestly, with this. We have to look at it. If you look at it, you're going to see a lot of ugly. There's no question about it. No question about it. But if we would be biblical people, if we would be people biblical just in identifying things, but also biblical in terms of having kingdom commitments to addressing these things. We can't just say, get over it, or we can't say it's not there. That doesn't mean it's there in the same way. Doesn't mean everything's horrible. Not saying that at all. But I'm saying sometimes there are a lot of things we just don't look at. And then you have one of those strange conversations one day, and you're like, what happened to that interaction? And you don't know what happened. But if you asked a few more questions, you might be surprised at what happened. Something was said, something was done, some assumption was made, and it reveals why this psychology of the modern West, you know, is there before us, and that we still have to deal with that, okay? And how that's penetrated into the way Christians operate. And this is very important to understand. This is not just a question for what people in the Free Church deal with. I'm talking about Christians, period. Black, white, Asian, Latino, etc. Everybody's got to deal with it. Everybody's got to deal with it. The great temptation is to say, can't we just, at least for a while, pretend that we have a realized eschatology and that everything is all good? I wish. But we can't. I don't think we can. Well, if we consider the experience of minorities, what can the church learn and perhaps anticipate in the future? Now, of course, there are many things one could say here, but there are two, they're really kind of opposing ways of thinking about it. Not in opposition to each other, but they go in different directions. But there are things to keep in mind, particularly when we're thinking about the way society is going, or could be going. I would say. I'm an optimist. So the first is this. The question of a lack of power. One of the interesting things about 12 Years a Slave with that hanging scene is that while he's hanging there, he's basically hanging there all day. And nobody can take him down. You see one other slave run up at one point. She's looking around, and she gives him some warning, and she runs off. But eventually, while he's still hanging there, here's the interesting things that happen. One, kids just come out and start playing, slave kids. Other slaves come out and just go, they're going about doing their work, and everybody's just doing what they do. One, they've seen it before, but second, nobody has the power to do anything about it. In fact, even other white people don't have any power to do anything about it. The only person that can cut him down is the actual slave owner himself. And you see again and again all these circumstances in the film where it's clear that there's just no power. And I don't mean power in the kind of totalitarian way. I just mean, you know, when we think about, you know, in the United States, we talk about rights. Okay, well, you know, rights for all is something we could talk about now. You couldn't talk about that even 60 years ago, much less before 1863. And here's the thing. Whether here or around the world, there are circumstances where there are people who are minorities of various kinds. They're placed in positions where their ability to influence society and or pursue or experience justice is limited or non-existent. You see, at the very end, when Solomon Northup finally gets freed because he meets a benevolent white person, basically, who writes a letter to the people back north, and they come and they get him. Because legally, he's legally free. Okay, but he had to rely on somebody else, first of all, to make that happen. But here's the thing. He literally walks from the field to this carriage, and then the slave, the one that got whipped within an inch of her life, she comes up, and she, you know, he embraces her, then he gets on, and they leave. But here's the thing. Only he leaves. When you see him leaving, you see everybody else in the background. You see all the other slaves. They're not going anywhere. You know why? Because they're property. They have no power. They can't say, we're going to rise up or whatever. No. There's no rising up, okay? I mean, people tried to rise up, but usually that resulted in death, is what that resulted in. So there's no power at all. The cards were held by someone else. I mean, and again, this isn't just what happened to the United States. Any of you have been to other parts of the world where stratification in society is much more clear? You see who has the power and who doesn't. I'll give you one example. When I was in Indonesia last June, it was curious to me that I was at this secondary school, kind of like a classical Christian school, sort of international baccalaureate type thing. And there were two elevators for the kids and faculty to go in. And then there was another elevator, you know. And the people who worked at the school rode in that elevator. And I remember talking to this guy who was from Canada who was working at the school. And he said he just came to recognize that even if he wanted to say, no, come on, you can ride in this elevator, right? The people who work in the building, they wouldn't dare ride that elevator. I mean, you know, in the United States, people would say, why aren't you riding in this elevator? You should, come on, it's all right, come on. Yeah, but see, you know what, I'm going back to America, okay? That's what I'm doing, right? So I can say that to him, because there's no consequence for me, right? The other person might lose his job. You violate the rules, you violate the system, you violate the structure. So the point is that there's lots of circumstances where you can see where people are absolutely lacking in power. And we find ourselves in a situation where if you are a Bible-believing Christian and you think certain things morally, where we see instances now where it seems like in a country that on paper says there's freedom of religious expression, things like freedom of association, etc., that, well, those aren't always true. That there are some notions of equality, one would say, that wind up trumping those things. And you see situations where it seems like Christians are having power taken from them, or where it could be the beginning of sort of the first domino in a whole series of dominoes falling, and then there's going to be an experience of having less power. It's hard to know. It's hard to know. Now, I think one thing to think about this is what kind of influence might be still present or might be lost. What kind of sort of social capital do we have? What kind of public influence? Are we in a place or moving to a place where Christians don't have capacity to be a shaping influence, or to have sufficient social capital such that when it comes to how decisions get made that reverberate through our society, that Christians play a role there. I think another way to think about it, though, is this. How much of this is because of Christians actually losing influence, or how much of it is because the advance of pluralism and the need to, or what that has to do with the need or not, the fact of there being a public domain where there's to be more worldviews in this public domain, which are sharing public space and influence, and then one has to navigate a new situation with these multiple worldviews and their various inputs into how society should go one way or another. That's another way to think about it. How much of it is the way of navigating pluralism and the fact of pluralism? So that's one dimension of it. Another way to think about it, the question of hope. So this question of power or lack of power, then there's the question of hope. Another interesting thing about 12 Years a Slave is that at least Solomon Northrop, even though he experiences the loss of power, and you see this in many ways, he never gives up hope. Now, he's a slave who doesn't. And you see some slaves that are holding on to a little bit of hope. Others completely devastated. There's an interesting line early in the film where in a slave market situation, a woman gets separated from her children. And when she gets to the plantation where she's at, another slave says to her, "You'll get over it. She'll get over it." Well, then what you keep seeing is she keeps crying for her children. Because she really has no hope of seeing them again. That's her expression of losing hope rather than having hope, right? But it's very interesting to think about this. It's something Henry Louis Gates said. I saw him talking about this in the Tavis Smiley show like a month ago. He said that one of the interesting things about what was going on with slavery in the United States is that you did have a significant contingent of slaves that did have hope. And the hope wasn't always just that hope for by and by, one day I'm going to see Jesus. It was hope that one day this whole situation was going to change. And they had this hope in the face of a reality which gave them no confidence at all that this situation would ever change. It was the law. It was the law. But they had hope that it would change anyway. And the question for us is this. When evangelicals start talking about losing influence in society, it's interesting to me to observe that what's not part of the discourse very often is actual hope as opposed to despair. Despair is more characteristic. Lament of losing some mythic thing called Christian America. I say mythic because, yes, Christian influence, Judeo-Christian worldview, of course. Somehow a new instantiation of God's chosen people, Israel? I don't think so. Okay, you know, George Washington is not Moses. You would think, according to some people, he is. So the point is that when people talk about what's happening to my country, our country, etc., what I wonder, now, by the way, there is, I hate to talk about this, but it's true, there is the financially motivated side of it where, you know, if you want to raise money, you raise money by scaring people, not by giving them hope. Okay, and I mean, people reach for their wallet if you say, this is going to happen, but if we address this, the people start doing this, right? I mean, they say, I'll write you a check. I think there's a side of it. Now, I don't think that's the only reason why people do things. I do think some people, it's how they keep things running. But it's just interesting that aside from that, I just don't hear a whole lot of rhetoric about the fact that irrespective of what direction society's going in, because I believe what I believe about God and what God's committed to and God's sovereignty in history, that, you know what, I have reason to be hopeful in spite of all appearances to the contrary, or slight appearances to the contrary. It's a very interesting thing. It's a very interesting thing. Why isn't that characteristic of our rhetoric about what's going on in public? It's very interesting to think about. Because it's impossible to read everything in this social media age. But I don't see a lot of the rhetoric being that way. It tends to be more about what bad things could happen. So I think the question of hope is an important one to consider, because that's certainly prominent, at least among minority Christians in the United States in the civil rights movement, during Jim Crow, and during the time of slavery. So the question of hope, question of the lack of power, I think those are really important ones to talk about. All right, we're going to move on to the next piece here. All right, considering some core beliefs. If we're going to talk about addressing race as Christians, or if we're going to talk about however we're contending with the public, period, how does what we actually believe play a role in all that, what we think about this? One of the things that is very important to me is the link between theology and ethics, okay? Between what we proclaim and what we practice. If you want to say the is and the ought, that's another way to do it. But the point is, it's very, very important to me that these things be seen together. And, you know, maybe we can blame the Enlightenment, okay? Maybe we can do that. But it's interesting that ethics often is over here, and then when we talk about what we believe, whether we're talking about biblical studies, whether we're talking about systematic theology, it's here, and ethics is over here. And the thing that always seemed counterintuitive about that to me was, how is it that if you're a Christian, these things that you're believing, you know, it's taking you a while to get that to relate to what you're doing? How could our beliefs and our practices not be interwoven? But sometimes there's like a lot of steps we wind up having to take to get to that point. And I just want to encourage us to think about, for example, how our Christology, soteriology, and ecclesiology might lead us to thinking about, now I'm using the term, persistent and patient progress, okay? And I did, and by progress, I really meant progress, okay? That doesn't mean, this is very important, sometimes people see the word progress, and the word progress is code for triumphalism. That's not what I'm talking about, okay? Let it not be said that I came here and said, yes, today we will go forward and triumph. You know, in other words, I came in here as sort of a certain kind of post-millennialist. No, I'm not. But I do believe that what we believe influences and ought to shape how we think about engaging this world, and that in that engagement with the world, that there are, of a sort, gains that can be made. Positive developments can occur in relationship to race or in relationship to being evangelicals who are cultural minorities. So with Christology, big question, what's our view of Jesus? And we have to ask questions like, when we think about that, how much of our view of Jesus is influenced by things other than what we see in Scripture? In other words, if I say, all right, write out in 5 words what you begin to say when you tell someone about Jesus, what trajectory are you taking? And what portrait of Jesus are you giving? Because there are lots of portraits of Jesus that people have. Even if they want to be completely, comprehensively biblical, something winds up being the centerpiece. And everything else is kind of like spokes around that or something. Something's more prominent. A way to think about it is this. I mean, what's the first text you would go to when you think about Christology? Because there are lots of different go-to texts for Christology. And by the way, when I say go-to text, I'm not saying you're proof texting or anything like that. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, where do you tend to go? If someone says, tell me about Jesus, you say, well, let's open to. Well, what are you opening to? Are you opening to Philippians 2? Are you opening to John 3? Are you opening to John 1? Is anyone opening, I wonder, to Luke 4:18? I mean, it's just interesting to think about, right? Where do you start? And when you talk about Jesus, I mean, what kind of Jesus Christ is this? So are you talking about the life of Jesus? Are you talking about the post-resurrection Jesus? Are you talking about the exalted and ascended Jesus? Which Jesus are you talking about? Now, perhaps most of you, most or all of you are saying, I'm talking about all of them, of course. Awesome. So, but the point is this. I mean, of course we emphasize things. Makes sense. Makes sense. But the Jesus that you emphasize, the one you preach about, the one you talk about all the time, you are, by what you emphasize, saying what about what it means to follow that Jesus? What it means to believe in that Jesus? What it means to worship that Jesus? It's very, very important to think about. The reason I asked about the Luke 4:18 one is because even if people start with Luke 4:18, sometimes the temptation is to say, he quoted Isaiah 61, but he didn't really mean what Isaiah 61 meant when he quoted that. It's like, well, yeah, I think he kind of did. I mean, because when John was in jail, he said, John said, is he really the one? I said, well, what am I doing? You know, I mean, he wasn't just spiritualizing, right? He was doing things, material things. So, you know, he was beginning to, you know, express what it meant to be this anointed one. I mean, if you use Luke 4:18, if you start there, for example, it doesn't mean that you're a liberation theologian or a liberation theologian of a certain kind, put it that way. It means you believe he's the anointed one, which you kind of can't miss if you look at the trajectory in Luke 4. I mean, it's telling you step by step by step, you better believe the Spirit is resting on this guy. This is who he is, and what does the anointed one do? What is he bringing about? So, some people like to talk about Jesus as prophet. Some like to talk about him as king. Some like to talk about him as a particular kind of savior or reconciler. I hope we talk about him in his fullness. But once you talk about him, how does that trickle down or play, or how does that a lens into how you think about what we do with our lives, what we do in the face of whatever is going on in society? Does Jesus give you a model to follow? Are there things that he taught that, or primarily, or strongly emphasized, that are things you want to emphasize that show us the way to deal with things like race or things like a society that may make us feel more and more countercultural? Is Jesus countercultural when you think about Jesus? Or do you think about Jesus as the one who, you know, shapes and informs the culture? He's the king of culture, etc. All those are really important questions to ask. More briefly, salvation. What's salvation all about? What's it all about? Is it just about justification? Now, I'm not when I say that, okay, in light of, you know, various books and conversations that have been going back and forth for, you know, almost a decade now. The point is not that we shouldn't talk about justification. We're Protestants. How can we not do that, right? Okay? So that's not my point. But I do sometimes wonder, if someone quotes Luther saying justification is the doctrine on which the church stands or falls, right? What I want to ask them is, are we in the same context Luther was in? And what about the Christians like centuries before that that didn't say the same thing? And were they missing something? I mean, I'm just curious. Because sometimes we say things like that, and there's a good point to them, but we can wind up then creating making a caricature or something, or really having a myopia in the way that we talk about salvation. Because think about it this way. If you look at everything that's gone wrong after Genesis 3, is justification, you know, conceptually competent to address all those things? To address all of it? Because there's a lot of stuff that goes wrong. A lot of stuff that goes wrong. Justification is obviously central to part of how of what goes wrong. But there's lots of things that go wrong. And when we talk about salvation, addressing all those things that go wrong, you know, what is Jesus doing in the end? What is he bringing? What is he bringing about? Of course he's bringing about reconciliation. Of course he's priest and lamb who atones for us. Of course we're justified. But what if we said something like, he's bringing shalom? What would that mean if that's what you're saying is going on in salvation? And then you start telling me what shalom is. Well, I hope you're going to talk about atonement and justification and sanctification and a lot of things. But that's just a for instance, right? Because sometimes we have ways we think about things, and we see ways other people have talked about things and left out things that are important to us. And the challenge for us then is to say, okay, even if I disagree with them, is there something that they're getting right that maybe I need to consider to fill out the way I'm talking about this? I guess an important thing for us to consider. So, you know, the same question that I asked with Christology is an interesting one. What would be a primary text for you in talking about salvation? I mean, is it, and Jesus appeared and said, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand? Or is it a text I said I'd never preach on, I have preached on it, I promise. Blame football games for this. John 3:16. Okay, God's love the world, you know. I mean, so, I have preached on it, I promise. I'm not just saying that. What text do you use to talk about salvation? And once you think about what salvation is, and of course, what was present and what's future, because you have to be thinking about all of that, what difference does that make then for how you think about what we should be doing, how we should be perceiving our moment, what we should be emphasizing, how we should be molding people, how we should be prompting people to engage in a society? What difference does that make? And then finally, ecclesiology. Church, who is it? What is it? People, institution? What do they do? What makes a church? When is a church? What's the relationship of church to the surrounding context? Does church as church ever say anything about what's outside of church in terms of the public? Or does the church just equip people who then go out and do it themselves as, you know, members of the church, but they do it as themselves? Very, very important question. Should pastors ever say anything in terms of whether it's preaching or whether they set aside a moment for pastoral comments, however they do it, or blogging or tweeting, however it works these days, where they say things about what's out there and not just about, you know, certain interpretations of texts or our theology, etc. Things that we should be talking about, okay? But should other statements be made? Should guidance be offered? Very, very huge question. I mean, you think of church as what? And after you think of church as what, then what? This is sort of my next question. Then what? So if someone asks about your church, what happens with your church in relationship to whatever is going on out there? The lingering problem of race, the changing culture around us, what's the relationship of your church to that? What do people encounter and experience at your church that makes them answer that question in a certain way, in one way or another? Important one to ask. So I was going to reiterate my theology and ethics thing here again, then I'll say these last few things and then I'll stop. So whether it's the question of race or diminished cultural influence, faithful practice faithful practice must be deeply linked to our beliefs. If we're going to be people of the book, are we considering all the book teaches us? It is shaping our view of the world. It is shaping our expectations. And is it shaping the expression of our witness? Is that what we're doing, or are we just pragmatists? It's a very important question to ask. All right, next point. What posture should we take, faithful presence or somewhere else? Okay, now, some of you may have read, maybe not, I don't know, but I wrote, and it came out last September, that's why I'm saying this, because maybe someone saw it somewhere. I wrote a journal article called Beyond Faithful Presence. So that probably tells you what I think about James Davison Hunter's book. But there's a lot of positive things in James Davison Hunter's book called To Change the World. Okay, because when people start talking about faithful presence, I mean, that's sort of his proposal at the end. And he does not mean what some would call a quietism. Just sit there and do nothing and watch the world go by. It's taking a step back from trying to be as directly influential, and I think particularly politically. He's very discouraged by some things that have happened with culture wars types of things, and with people believing that politics alone are the way to make changes in society. The reason why I have a critique of Hunter isn't because of how he talks about how change occurs in society. I think that's one of his strongest points, actually. One is because he seems to suggest at the end that if Christians are committed to changing the world, that because we believe God gives us a rationale for changing the world, that our being convinced of that then also means that we'll feel okay with pretty much whatever strategy we come up with. And when I read that part in the last page, I thought, what are you talking about? Is honestly what I thought. Because that suggests that people have no capacity for critical thinking whatsoever. And he's trying to encourage people to have critical thinking, I think, in the book. So he seemed to have left it out at that point to me. And the bigger thing for me is faithful presence, by which he means, again, Christians should participate in law, in politics, in education, in medicine, etc. They should be there and in their little world be faithful and be Christ-like and care about not just people that are like you, but people that are different from you. In other words, not just the Christians around you. And if there's opportunity for you to be, you know, have little, you know, opportunities for influence, please take those opportunities. But he wanted people to, you know, there's the phrase, go big or go home. He definitely wanted to avoid that way of thinking about things. No, don't go big, because people have tried to go big and it's made a mess of things. I don't think it's enough because, in my view, faithful presence is something that you can afford when the stakes aren't that high for you. If you're in a certain context of crisis, and if you're in a context like the United States where, even though the culture is changing, it's still a culture, a social context where you can participate in the structures of society. And by participating in those structures of society, perhaps be very influential in certain areas. That where that's possible, that I think people should do it. Doesn't mean everybody should do it. It's too great a temptation for a lot of people if they're in a place of power and influence, you know? But if there are crises and great ones, And there's opportunity to somehow be involved in addressing those in a big way, whether it's public policy, educational policy, whatever. I think people should do it. Doesn't mean everyone should do it, but some people should. And the other thing, I guess, is that I just don't think when it comes to people who are minorities, and particularly poorer minorities, I would say, faithful presence winds up sounding a lot like Reinhold Niebuhr saying, let's just go slow on race. It's easy to go slow on race, you know, when your pigmentation is very light. You know, it's like, say that to somebody, you know, whose relatives got lynched. You know, say that to Emmett Till's mom. It's easier to say when the stakes aren't as high for you. So when the stakes are higher, I don't think faithful presence is an option. Comma, big comma. But if you're in a context that doesn't allow you the opportunity for public influence, faithful presence may be all you have. You may be like a Mennonite, an Anabaptist, where the only influence you're going to have is within your church community, and you will model an alternative witness. Because there are places around the world where you don't have the opportunity to be an influence. So your context makes a huge difference in what your options are. Because some societies don't allow you to do anything because you are not going to be a person of power. You're not going to be one of them. You're going to be on the outside. And as someone on the outside, you need to model another reality. So even if you have massive disagreements with Anabaptists, you might wind up looking like one in practice anyway, in terms of what you do as a group, as a community, together. So we have to always ask, well, what are the options that are actually possible within a country? And even though there are things that are changing in our society, it still remains at this point the possibility for us to be people who can be in places of influence. Now, this is very important to say. The point about pursuing influence, being a transformationist, as I like to say, is not triumphalism. I said that once before. I want to reiterate that. And it's not that one has some kind of delusion that if people just do things your way or your strategy or your plan, well, then the kingdom will come. No! It's really an expression of faithful witness as someone who recognizes that I'm a citizen of another kingdom and I can at least witness to this reality in this way. And there can be, whether you want to use the term outpost, whether this is an instance, just a slight vision, a slight glimpse, slight preview of what kingdom reality is. If that is possible, then we should do it. The point isn't necessarily that, you know, you either, you know, take over the whole world or do nothing. But to be a witness, to be salt and light, to be known for being salt and light, provide at least glimmers of kingdom reality by participation in society is something I think we should encourage. In this country, we can do that. Other countries, different story. You know, it's not happening in North Korea. Okay? It's not happening in China. It's not likely to happen in India. I mean, there's a lot of things happening in India, but it's still harder to do there. So, among other places. So, we have to think, what options are possible for us? We've got more options here than people do in a lot of other places. All right, last. What vision might we have for the future? Well, one is this. I've suggested this, but I'll be more explicit about it. At one level, Christians ought to really be a truly countercultural people who practice a countercultural reality. One way that Christians can do that, this brings us back to the question of race. If you have churches where people from different ethnicities are actually worshiping and serving together, and really worshiping and serving together and getting to know each other, and being patient with getting to know each other, because it will take massive patience, it will take massive amounts of forgiveness, massive toleration for misunderstanding, all those kinds of things. But if people are really living together, people will notice. Why? Because it's not typical for people who aren't like each other to live together. That's not typical. For all the things that have gotten better about racial and ethnic issues, the fact is that most people still pretty much hang out with people that look like them all around the world. If people see churches, these different people, really living together, they're like, what's going on there? They act like they really love each other. And they're not the same. What's that? Well, it's an outpost of the kingdom, I believe. Second, I think we have to have a disposition of massive patience amid both progress and regression, because positive things can still happen, though we obviously see negative things happen. I mean, one can easily argue that we live in a society where there's not much of a moral compass. I mean, it's very much a create your moral compass type of reality, where people want to say very often, hey, you know, I can't, let's just love everybody and let everybody do what they want to do. And what they really mean by do what you want to do is do what you want to do as long as it doesn't harm me, is what they mean. Just go ahead, it's fine. It's very hard to really sustain a society with what amounts to kind of moral anarchy, I believe. I think people, they want a mythology that progress actually looks like a kind of everybody loves each other without ever saying that we need to hold people to moral standards, except when it's really egregious. And we sort of agree that it's egregious. I say sort of, because you even get people who will say, like Richard Dawkins actually said, he came under fire for this, but he was saying, well, you know, I mean, I kind of experienced some, the affections of a pedophile, you know, when I was at school, etc. And, you know, it's just kind of what he did or whatever. I mean, he kind of brushed it aside. It was really interesting. He didn't pass a moral judgment on it. Well, that didn't fly over so well. But there are probably other people who think, well, you know, I mean, is it really wrong in every circumstance, etc.? Isn't there some kind of consensual circumstance in some of these cases, etc.? I don't think so. But some people might say that because, you know, the moral compass is all over the place. Another thing to think about in terms of regression, by the way, is regression is not just something that happens out there. It happens within the church as well. Simple example. An easy example is, you know, the crisis about marriage is not just outside the church. It's inside the church. And the fact of the crisis of marriage is, in the United States at least, all the cohabitation, single parenting, etc., you know, when it's outside of Hollywood, I mean, it just spells, you know, trouble for the children born of those situations. It's very hard for those children to flourish. Now, on one level, it's an opportunity for the church to say it doesn't have to be like that. But, I mean, but part of the difficulties in our society is certainly tied to that. So, but we have to attend to those things, but we also have to be patient because change doesn't always happen like that. All right, two more things, and then we're done. Questions. One, it's important, I think, that we consider how to expand our vision when we talk about public matters to public concerns that are beyond but not instead of, beyond but not instead of, typical concerns. Now, what's interesting is, some people usually like to say abortion and gay marriage. Interesting about abortion, abortion has actually not had the same level of attention that it had 10 years ago, 15 years ago, et cetera. And it's still a problem. In fact, there was a survey that showed something like the percentage of pregnancies terminated in New York City in 2011 was something like 46%. Something like that. Disproportionately higher among minorities. So that needs to be addressed. But those aren't the only moral issues or the only public issues. The question is just to think about, well, what else are concerns that we should talk about? And then a last piece of vision, I think, it kind of just goes on something I said already, and that is a commitment to public engagement without messianic or triumphalist visions. To say we should be involved in society and want society to trend somewhere doesn't mean that we confuse ourselves with the Messiah or that we think that we have the perfect strategy for making it all happen if you would just do it our way. Because a lot of times people get nervous about that. But I don't think the specter of triumphalism or the temptation toward it isn't reason to not say we shouldn't be concerned about society and where it goes. If we have a vision for where society could go and it is bathed in humility, it's very hard to be a triumphalist. You can have vision, you can have a big hope for something, but you can be humble about it too. And I think that's an important thing. I think some of the people fear, oh, they think they're going to just do dot, 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 dot. And they really think a lot of themselves, don't they? Sometimes that says more about the people that are criticizing them than about the people who are doing it, but sometimes they're telling the truth as well. So I just want to encourage a commitment to public engagement while resisting the temptation to triumphalism. So last thing I want to say is this. We must look unflinchingly at all of the challenges before us and remain people of hope who are persistent in engagement. Though we must have an openness and creativity about whatever strategies we propose and implement. To be a witness and to be salt and light isn't optional. It's not an option. And if we're going to be witnesses who are this salt and light, do we dare to be such witnesses as people of hope who are capable of different strategies in increasingly post-Christian society? That's a big question for us. And now I'll take questions, however that works, because I don't see microphones, but I assume there are microphones somewhere. So thanks.
There are. We'll take just a few minutes for questions, and just a couple, and then what we'll do is if you didn't get your question asked or answered, there will be a breakout session that Vincent will lead. And so if there are a couple of questions, we would take those. Thank you, by the way, Vincent, for your lecture. Yes.
I served for 6 years, really, really long 6 years in the rural South, where they still have two proms in our schools. And I moved here to Johnson County, where race is not a huge issue. It's just not in front of us. Mm-hmm. And you've helped me realize something very important, that I'm not guilty of segregating race, but I am guilty of segregating racists. That's what we've segregated, is those are the people who are different than I am. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and I've segregated them. And in Christ, I can't continue to do that. And you've helped me understand that. So I just thank you for that. Mm.
You know what's interesting about that is we're all tempted to put somebody in some category of other, where I'm not them. And by virtue of not being them, it's not even necessarily that it elevates us above them, but it's like, well, at least I'm not doing what they're doing. And the thing is, though, is that those people still need the gospel. Or if they think they have the gospel, we need to help them see. You know, the gospel actually penetrates to some areas of your life that you may not be aware of. And, you know, I think we have to constantly be aware of how easy it is for us to say, one of these doesn't belong, and it's that one over there, not this one.
I've heard it said in different ways many times over my career as a pastor that...
Is that a Minnesota M, by the way?
No, that's a Michigan M, and I wish you'd take that Minnesota back.
I'm sorry. You know what? See, I couldn't tell what color your shirt was. I'm sorry. Michigan, hey. All right, great. Sorry.
Oh, see? Okay. By the way, we beat Iowa last night in basketball. Crickets. Oh, sorry. I've heard it said many different ways over my career as a pastor and working with students that Sunday morning is the most segregated day. We go to our denominational isms and we go to our racial centers. Could you speak on that a little bit? And also in an era where the evangelical church is trying to reach out to have Hispanic congregations within our churches and have different cultural centers. Positive, negatives, good, bad, ugly, and hopefully you'll agree with me because you hurt me before.
About the M? You know what it was? There was a Michigan highlight I saw on ESPN. I mean, I'm sorry, it was a Minnesota highlight I saw on ESPN. But I was trying to discern which kind of M it was. I know, and hey, look, I know lots of big blue people. So the tricky thing about the most segregated hour of the week thing, or the challenge, is this. In some areas, the geography just isn't going to allow anything else, barring a massive transportation program, okay? Okay, because it's like, well, those people are migrating dozens of miles. I mean, we're not going to have that kind of diversity. And at one level, here's the reason why Sunday being a segregated hour is a problem. It's a problem when people congregate with their kind, whatever their kind is, and it reinforces their way of thinking they're different from other people. If you had congregations and they're racially segregated and people are just enjoying the culture, the way of worshiping, preaching, etc. But they also knew the people who weren't like them that worshiped elsewhere, those really are my brothers and sisters. And I love them and I'm committed to them. If that was the case, we wouldn't need to talk about integrated churches. The reason we're talking about integrated churches is because segregated churches become ways that people easily reinforce being their kind. And by virtue of being their kind, especially if their kind are the ones who are in power versus the ones who aren't, people then aren't formed in those churches to see that they really need to see themselves as the brothers and sisters of those who are culturally different, etc. And to affirm and celebrate those and recognize that they can learn from them. Because if that was the case, then one of the big problems that happens with integration congregations is, how do you do the cultural integration? The different ways of doing leadership, the different ways of speaking, the different ways of navigating time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If I mean, if people could appreciate the differences, then the, I don't think we would need that. But we need it because we're in a world where we've so solidified identities connected by race and culture. And there have been ways that those have been, for the people in power, you know, a way to just kind of rest in it. And for others, a way of shoring up their identity by being there. That, you know, that the separation's helpful for some people, or at least helpful for those who aren't in power in certain ways. And then when they come together, the reason some people don't want integrated ones is why? Well, because then we're losing stuff. We're sacrificing what we are. So there's a big identity question there, right? So I think what we have to recognize is that there's a problem that integrated churches can help address. But it's very, very hard for churches to do that. Because it takes a lot. A lot of sharing. I mean, everybody's going to be giving up something, and people—it's very hard for people to do that. Which doesn't mean they shouldn't do it, but it becomes very hard. Regarding having, you know, say a Spanish language congregation or something—I mean, that can be, I think, a way that's helpful if there's actual relationships and they're not really like two countries that share the same space, but they're two countries and they stay in their countries. Because one country shows up, you know, when someone else isn't in the space, then the other country shows up, you know, when, you know, at the other time. And so that there isn't much actual interaction between them. If there's interaction between them, I mean, that can be very helpful. And of course, the tricky thing about, you know, the language piece is how do you make the most of that while, if you're in the United States, also helping people, if you have people who aren't native English speakers, helping them learn English as well. Not to the exclusion of knowing Spanish, but because to flourish in the United States pretty much takes English. So is that happening as well as celebrating the culture when people are worshiping and serving, you know, in Spanish or another language? I think that's part of what you have to address. So that's part of the answer. I mean, it's like a book length response is really required too, for your question. But
thank you. We will take a break here. Thank you very much. Let's thank Vincent for his lecture.